Okay, Erev Tov, Shavuot Tov. Just give a brief introduction, a pleasure to have Dr. Feintuch, who is a native Torontonian, I believe you can say, although he made Aliyah with his parents at the age of one. And half your life, and that's just, I doubled your time
he's
in Toronto.
He's Canadian, okay.
And he spent the year back here in Orfeim in high school. He lives in Yerushalayim with his wife and six kids. That's the most important thing. The side point is, right? You would agree with that.
Yes.
The side points are he teaches at Berlin University. I think now more at Herzog College in the Gush, that does a lot of the training for teachers in Tanakh and the whole reading, the center today in the religious Zionist world of the study of Tanakh. He teaches in Migdal Oz. And his book being published by Koren, you know, the Magid, which is a division of Koren, will be coming out in a couple of weeks on Agadah Halakha, which is his specialty. And without further ado, Bakasha.
Okay, so Shavuot Tov. Have you ever wondered why in the calendar, the English calendar, why did the date change at midnight? As a student, I think about that a lot. I was thinking, what actually happens at midnight? And the problem is that the answer is that nothing much happens. You could try it at home tonight. You can go out at midnight and look around. Okay, look at the sky, look around you. Nothing really changes in nature, right? You don't really feel anything changing. So why do they change the date at midnight? And when you think about it, the same question applies to the beginning of the year in the English calendar, which is coming up soon, right? New Year's, it's January. But what happens in January? There's nothing happening. Right? It's just the middle of winter, and it's just another wintry day. Okay, that nothing to do with any change or transition in nature. So why does it work like that? Why did they create the calendar like that? Now, maybe some of you are thinking, what do you mean? I mean, we all know December 25th, right, is Christmas because what's his name was born on December 25th. He who must not be named, maybe. But the Gemara calls him Yeshu, and that's what we all thought his name was, but actually, later on, I heard that if you say that to a Christian who understands Hebrew, they're actually insulted. Real name was actually Yeshua, Josh maybe, but Yeshua is what the Gemara uses as the Rashi Tevot of Yimachshmo V'Zikro and everything. Anyway, getting back to his supposed birthday, and we know this is not really probably his historical birthday. Even you can see the different churches have a debate between them when it is, and maybe none of those dates. But the beginning of the year in January actually predates that. Okay, the English calendar didn't really start out as a Christian calendar. It started out as a Roman calendar. It's actually, today, it's the Gregorian calendar, but originally the Julian calendar, Julius Caesar, right? He instated that calendar, which is the basis for the calendar that is used today. And so why did they do that? Why should the year start just in the middle of the winter when nothing is happening in nature? Today we're not so connected to nature, but in the ancient world, okay, people really knew about nature. It was part of their lives. Okay, so why should the date change in midnight and why in the middle of the winter? Now, you may say, what are you asking questions about this? Okay. Don't understand why they do things. They should, maybe there's no logical reason. But I think that Chazal Dafka looked at this differently, and I think there is a certain logic. Just you need to think about it a little bit. And I would like to take a little journey tonight through two stories in the Gemara. And the first of them is in Masechet Avodah Zarah, and it deals with this. And I think we'll find a surprising view there about the calendar and the holidays that are in the air here right now. Now, the Mishnah in Avodah Zarah lists a few of their holidays, the pagan holidays, Roman pagan holidays. And the Gemara goes on to explain some of those dates, especially in the Bavli, since in Eretz Israel, the Gentile culture was the Roman culture, and they had these Roman pagan holidays. But in Babel, in Babylonia, it was a totally different culture. So people living in Babylonia wouldn't necessarily understand what these holidays, this list in the Mishnah, is about. So the Gemara in the Bavli explains, and if you look at your source sheet, you'll see in source number one, and dafchet amalav kanan barava kalenda shmona yamim achar tkufa satamnua shmona yamim lifnei tkufa. Okay, they explain that there are these two holidays, two pagan holidays, Kalenda and Saturnura, which actually is the Roman holiday of Saturnalia. Saturnalia, like it sounds, it's connected to Saturn. And this was a holiday in December. And when they say 8 days before the Tkufa, okay, what is the Tkufa? The Tkufa is actually the winter solstice, okay, which is the day where the days stop becoming shorter and become longer, and the nights are becoming shorter. Okay? Now, today, that's December 21st, sometimes 22nd. That's not a very significant date. But don't forget, we're using the Gregorian calendar. In the original Julian calendar, it was December 25th. Okay? So that rings a bell. And that was the day where the whole thing changed. Days stopped becoming shorter and started becoming longer. And the Gemara goes on to tell us a story about Adam HaRishon. Tanu Rabbanan, lefi shiraa Adam HaRishon yom shemitmaet veolech. He saw that the days are getting gradually shorter. And this is his first year that he's alive, right? His first winter. And he panics. He says, "Oy li shema b'shvil shesarachti olam chashuch ba'adi v'chozer l'tov v'vohu v'zoy mita shenikmesa alay min ha'shamayim." Okay, perhaps because I have sinned, the sin in Gan Eden, right, eating from the tree, and originally said that he would die, so I said maybe this is the death, maybe this is the punishment, the world is coming to an end, the days keep becoming shorter and shorter, eventually there will be only darkness, and darkness is what was there before the creation of the world. So the world is coming to an end. And so he reacts to that, and he said, "And Amad v'yashav shmona yamim b'tanit v'tfila." So he sits for 8 days in fasting and prayer. And then what happens? We reach the 25th of December, and then it changes, right? The days start getting longer. Kivan shela'at tkufat tevet. Okay, the December didn't exist yet at the time of Adam HaRishon, but he saw that, the days are becoming longer. Okay, so it's just a cycle. It's just the course of nature, the course of the world. That's the way things go. It's just physics. And there's nothing to worry about. So he made another 8 days of holiday, festivity. That's a very good question. I'm gonna relate to that too. The question was, why didn't he believe that his prayer helped? Right? He didn't say my prayers were answered. He said this is the cycle, a natural cycle in the world. Right? Okay, I'll relate to that too. So he went and made 8 days of a holiday, right? Festivity. And the next year, the following year, the Shana Acheret, Asa'an Le'elu Ve'elu Yamim Tovim. So he made the next year, and from then on, he made two holidays. he celebrated the first 8 days, which he originally prayed and fasted in, right? And he celebrated the other set of 8 days. So he made 2 8-day holidays, okay, before and after the solstice. Hukva Nishem Shemaim, he fixed them for the sake of heaven, but the idol worshippers, Hentvom Nishem Uvat Bechovim. Okay, this is the story in the Gemara. Now, obviously, the story, when we read it, it raises a couple of questions. Okay, one of them was, why did he decide this is the natural cycle of the world? Okay, and that's a good question. I'm not exactly sure why he thought that, but I guess it was because he was seeing that the days are gradually getting shorter and then gradually getting longer. So maybe he just decided, but the truth is, I think the more important thing is, see, this is not definitely a historical story, right? It's not really saying what happened to Adam Rishon. It's trying to convey a message, and that's why I think the fact that he said it's the natural course of the world raises a different question, which is, why the following year, why does he celebrate both sets of 8 days? I mean, the second time, right, the second 8 days, which he celebrated, okay, that's the reason, there's a reason for celebration, because he saw that everything's okay, and the world isn't coming to an end, and there's a reason to have a celebration. But why is he celebrating the first 8 days when he fasted, when he thought that everything is coming to an end? What's there to celebrate? Is there a reason for the number eight? Well, first of all, if you look at those pagan holidays, okay, Saturnalia was actually more or less 8 days before the 25th of December, okay? And Calenda, which is actually in Latin, it's calends, was January 1st, so that's also approximately 8 days. I think maybe the reason that they decided that in the story here that it's 8 days, it's hinting to something that has to do with Hanukkah as well. Okay, because there's a real connection here. But that's just a hint, because Hanukkah isn't mentioned explicitly here. Okay, but I'm really trying to understand why he was celebrating the first 8 days. I mean, if a person receives, okay, bad news, all right, Chas v'Shalom, a bad medical examination, okay, and he sees it in trouble, and then later on, things he gets better. So he'll celebrate the day that he got better. He's not going to celebrate the day that he received, right, those terrible news. Why is he celebrating the first 8 days? And I think you can answer this, you can give two different answers. The first answer is, and that has to do with understanding what Minagol Shel Olam means, the course of the world. See, when we read it here, originally, I think we understand that it's talking about physics, right? That's the way that the planets move, and that's the way that the world of nature works. Okay, in winter, the days get shorter and then they just get longer. But I think there's a deeper meaning here. And I think we know that in many situations, when something not so good happens, the difficult situation that we're in causes us to find new strengths in ourselves and new ideas. And we think of a new way of looking at things, and many, many things that we wouldn't have thought of, or we wouldn't have known, different abilities that we wouldn't have known even existed inside us if we hadn't had this trouble, this difficult situation. I can tell you, personally, I've gone through all kinds of stuff. I think that the best ideas I've had, and some of the most important milestones in my life were not the times that I succeeded, but the times that I failed. And failure actually caused me to rethink things to look inside myself and to see, not just in the sense of tshuva and see what I did wrong, but actually what other strengths, what other abilities can I discover inside myself? What type of resources do I have that I never knew about? And I discover them, and then I can have a new plan. And I can do it. If it's a job that I wanted and I didn't get, so I can rethink what other abilities, what new abilities, what new talents, what can I do? And this means that a lot of times on the way to redemption, or on the way to things getting better, the turning point is not only when they really start getting better, but many times the turning point is when things actually get hard. That's the beginning of the turning point. It helps you. It doesn't always work. We know that. And we know that difficult situations, sometimes they bring out the worst in people, but sometimes they also bring out the best, and they give new opportunities. And in that sense, the time of the darkness is many times the actual beginning of something new. And that is why I think one reason why the following year, he understood that he wants to celebrate not only the days getting lighter, but also the days getting darker, when it actually caused him to think and to find and to look inside himself and to explore what he needs to do. So that's one sense. But I think there's another idea here. I think that that has to do with what you were saying, and I think that's why the story tells it like that. What is Prayer's answer? The answer is no. Right? Because at least the way he perceived it, it's just the natural course of the world. Nothing to do with his prayers and his fasting. So, what are the prayers worth? What's he celebrating? I think that when he discovers that it's not all about him, and his prayers may not have been directly answered, he finds that he actually discovered something else in prayer. Not just prayer that is meant to achieve something, to receive something from God. Because, as we all know, when we daven, we don't always get what we ask for. And this is very interesting. I think one of the things I like about this Haggadah, I think Chazal here are way ahead of their time. They're really diving here into modern spiritual or theological issues. When people feel, I think in the ancient world, people didn't feel like that. But I think today, right, people feel that you daven many times, and many times it's left unanswered. Right? You don't get what you actually asked for. I remember, it's very hard to forget, one of the years ago when a soldier, Nachshon Waxman, was kidnapped, right, by Hamas, and they were holding him for 2 days in this house. And the army decided to try to get him out. And it didn't really work out too well, because when they were barging in there, so the terrorists killed him. And then they asked his father, he said, for 2 days, I remember, we were saying to him, like, nonstop and praying and that he should get out alive. And they asked his father after that, on the news, they asked him, so nobody heard your prayer, so your prayer really was futile, and nobody was listening? He said, that's not how I look at it. Right? Hashem was listening. And he had to answer, and he said no. He could choose to say yes. Sometimes he says yes, sometimes he says no, but he was listening. And I think Adam Rishon, that the story is saying that what he discovers, the world of prayer, but in a deeper sense than just asking for something and receiving what you ask for. He discovers prayer as a way to converse with God, as a way to communicate. Prayer is really much more than just give and take. It's actually, give and take in prayer is a pagan concept. The deeper sense is the fact that he can open his heart and pray. That's not to be taken for granted. And this may be what he's actually celebrating. Now, by describing this, in this story, what are the rabbis actually saying about these pagan holidays? They're saying that they have an original source, right, an original kernel, which was created many years before they celebrate these Roman holidays. Now, again, this is not necessarily a historical story, right? It's not saying Adam and Rishon necessarily actually went through this and celebrated those two holidays. What it's saying actually is that in these holidays that the pagans celebrate in the middle of winter, there's a very interesting logic, which is actually a basic universal logic. The fear of darkness, the fear of the world coming to an end. Again, in modern times, it's very hard to feel it, but nighttime in ancient times was a frightening time. It was frightening at night. There was no light, no heat. It was cold, and it was dark. And people were really afraid of night. And today, it looks more like a symbol. We can talk about it as symbols. Day as a symbol for good, and night as a symbol for bad. Right? We say that in the morning, in davening, we say, Shacharit Yotzer Or Borei Choshech, Oseh Shalom, Borei Hakol, which is based on the original Pasuk in Yeshayahu, right? Oseh Yotzer Or Borei Choshech, Oseh Shalom, Borei Ra. Okay, so Or is Tov, Shalom, and Choshech is Ra. So day symbolizes good, and night symbolizes evil. And people really felt that. And so this is a very universal thing. And it is not surprising that we also have a holiday, Hanukkah, at more or less that time of year, which is also a holiday of lights, okay? Celebrating lighting up the darkness. So it also, of course, has to do with the historical story of the Maccabees, but this is something very deep in human nature that goes across cultures. But the problem is this, what are Chazal actually doing here? They're actually looking at these pagan holidays, okay, and seeing the logic. It's not just human logic, it's a religious, theological logic here. Okay, is that what they really want to do? So here I think we actually get to look at a very interesting dynamic between halakha and agada. Because if you look at the halakhic context, this story in the Gemara, okay, that's in the second source here. The Mishnah, what's the context here? Why is the Mishnah mentioning these holidays? It brings a very strict halacha here. It says, Mishnah of Avodah Zarah, okay, I'll read it straight from the English. On the 3 days preceding the festivities of idolaters, it is forbidden to transact business with them. Okay, to lend articles to them, to borrow any from them, to advance or receive any money from them, to repay a debt, receive repayments for them. In short, no economic interaction, no interactions whatsoever, okay, with Gentiles around their holidays, their religious holidays. The Mishnah is actually creating a very solid boundary between Jews and Goyim, right, around their holidays. Actually say don't go anywhere near them, okay? A few days before. And later on it says also a few days after in the Gemara. So it's creating a very big distance. It's distancing us from these Gentile holidays. So this seems to contradict what the story is talking about. Right? Because on one hand, the Mishnah says, keep away. Don't have anything to do with them. Alright, so there shouldn't be even a chashash that anything you did, right, was helping them celebrate their holidays or bring their sacrifices. So keep a distance. And then the story comes right after that and says, well, it looks at in what you can see as a positive way of seeing the maybe the sort of truth in their holidays, a kernel of truth. But this is exactly the way that I spoke about this earlier in Sudash Lishit, the way the halacha and agada often interact. Halacha and agada speak different languages. And sometimes they create what looks like a contrast, but they actually complement each other by contradicting each other. See, first of all, we have an halachic plane. The halacha forbids us to go anywhere near those holidays. And make sure, okay, that there's a very solid barrier between Jews and Gentile holidays, okay, the religious pagan holidays. But after that is said, the fact that there's such a solid boundary creates enormous freedom to actually look again at those holidays and see the positive side, and see the even religious truth in them. And you know that they say that a good solid fence creates good neighbors. Okay, so we have these two types of movement interacting. Okay, on one hand, distancing us from those holidays, but once the distance is safe, then that allows a lot of theological freedom. Now, in many generations, this wasn't exactly the way people looked at it, right? We all know that in Europe, when Christmas came, okay, so people even felt it was Nittenlacht, right? People felt they can't even learn Torah that night, Christmas Eve, right? People would play cards instead of learning. People who learned all year long would play cards, okay, in order to show that this is not a special night and we're doing something that has nothing to do with Kedusha, right? But I think it's part of history advancing, maybe, that as it becomes safer and more clearer that there's a distance. At least, I don't know, I admit, since I don't live here, it's hard for me to say how it is here. I know in Israel that the Christmas and all these holidays are so far away from the culture. So nobody's afraid of, and I don't know how it is here, how the feeling is here at this time, all the holidays. Is it safe? Do people feel safe enough that it's not going to become part of your religious, I see it a lot. I mean, when you walk around here, you see it's so present. But on the other hand, I don't know, it's not a real religious thing. I don't know, mainly around Santa and all this kid stuff. It's not really something serious that threatens Judaism. But that's...
Actually, it's really the other way around. There's an attack on Christians for trying to take, you know, the Christmas, the Yoshua out of Christmas. Right? So I think they feel under attack more than any influencing us.
So I think that's more or less what they felt here in the Gemara, that if the boundary is safe enough, then you don't even feel threatened, that you can actually think about these holidays and see that there is a certain thing here that makes sense. So what's the logic in having New Year's in the winter? It has to do with this story. It has to do with the feeling that something is changing, right? That the days are becoming, they became shorter, now they're becoming longer. And it's something it's not so easy to sense this in the air at a certain moment, but there is a certain logic to it. Still, the logic of the Hebrew calendar is different. And it works according to, mainly if you start on Tishrei, right? Rosh Hashanah today. So it fits the agricultural year in Israel and in the Northern Hemisphere. So that's much more connected to nature. But still, there is a certain logic here. And that may be the logic of the day changing at midnight, too. Because it's, again, the middle of the darkness. Okay, so at least symbolically. If you look at Masechet Brachot, at the first chapter, you see a lot of thought there about night and day being actually symbols of, like I said before, good and evil. It's a real, a major part of the discussions there. And if you look at it that way, so there may be something in the middle of the night of changing something, changing the date like that. Although I think there's another thing that we'll see soon. But before that, I just want to emphasize, again, how halacha and agadah work together. Okay, so, and this happens in many places. they create a contrast. And they sort of, but actually they complement each other. Okay, they interact here together in a way that they work on different planes. But the halakha creates a safe enough boundary for the Agadah to be with less limits, with greater freedom of thought, and to look at difficult issues in creative ways. And that's what I think is actually happening here in the Gemara. Now they made it, maybe they even felt safer in Babylonia, because in Babylonia they didn't have these pagan holidays, they had other holidays. Babylonia, the year didn't begin in the surrounding culture in January. It began in spring, in the sun. Okay, that was the Babylonian culture, the Persian culture of the Persian religion. But I think midnight is, there's also another thing in a different story that can teach us something interesting about that time, midnight, that nothing actually really happens at that time. And this is a story in Masechet Brachot. And like I said before, we all know how the Shas begins, right? It starts, if you look at page 3 here, Mematai kolin et Shema ba'avim. What time can you recite the Shema in the evening? And the Gemara right away jumps up and asks, what kind of beginning is that? I mean, you didn't even tell us that such a mitzvah exists, Kriya Shema, and where does it come from? What's the source? And what's its meaning? You right away you jump to saying what the time is. What kind of thing is that? So the Gemara answers what it answers, and it goes back to the Torah as a source. And everything. But I think what the Gemara is being sensitive to here is that Rebbe, when he creates the Mishnah, when he redacts this chapter in the Mishnah, throughout the whole first chapter, it's not really dealing with the essentials of what Kriya Shema means. There's a lot of time there, a lot of dealing with different times of Kriya Shema, and especially with day and night. Throughout the whole chapter, you see that day and night are themes that, they're like keywords, they repeat themselves. And if you look at the Gemara responds to that too, and there's a lot of material in the Gemara in the first chapter that has nothing to do with Kriya Shema, but has to do with day and night and what they symbolize. There's a lot of that. Now we know that in the first Mishnah, if I continue reading here, so the beginning is Mishasha Kwanim Khasim Nakol Bitumata Atsofa Shmura Hishona. So the beginning is at the beginning of the night, which is actually when the sun sets or tzeta kochavim, and Atsofa Shmura Hishona, what does that mean? The till the end of the first watch. What is the first watch? The night is divided into watches or shifts. Right? This is based on the heavenly activity of the angels, and they switch watches or guards or shifts, okay, three times during the night. They're three different watches or three different shifts, but it's a debate whether there are three and four, whether the night is divided into three or four. And if you look at source 2 here, it says, Tanu Rabana, Alba Mishmahot Avi Alayla Dvre Rabim. So Rebbe thought that actually there are four. Rabinatan Omer Shalosh. Okay, let's read it straight from the English, okay? So there's a machloket here, there's a debate here, whether there are three watches or four watches. And then the Gemara asks, what's the reason of Rabbi Natan? So it is written, so Gidon, Sefer Shoftim, right? The story of his battle there. And the 100 men that were with him came into the outermost part of the camp in the beginning of the middle watch. Okay, now if there's the middle watch, then there's three, right? Because you have to have an odd number in order to have a middle watch, okay? Now, if we try to go beyond that, what does it mean? What does it mean that they're bringing the source here from Gidon? What is it describing? It's describing war, describing a battle, and that fits what we said about nighttime. Nighttime is a difficult time of midat hadin war of evil, okay? But then we look at the other opinion here. What is Rebbe's reason. Rebbe Zvika, in the name of Rebbe Shem, and Levi says, one verse reads, at midnight do I rise to give thanks unto thee because of thy righteous ordinances. That's Tehillim, okay, David HaMelech. And another verse reads, my eyes forestall the watches, which is actually saying that they're actually, well, we see that if he, at the middle of the night, at midnight, it's before two watches, okay, or at least more than one, then you need to have four watches during the night. Okay, we learn from David HaMelech, he says that at midnight, it's right before the two watches, okay, so then there are two after midnight and two before midnight. Now, besides the technical issue here, what is it actually saying? It's learning about night from a very different perspective. In Gidon there, the perspective was war, okay, which is fitting to what night usually symbolizes in these sugyot. But here, David HaMelech is doing something very different during nighttime. And the sugya continues and brings us an agadita about David HaMelech, if you follow on the other side of the page. Ravashi says, till midnight he studied the Torah, from thence on he recited songs and praises. But did David know the exact time of midnight? Even our teacher Moses did not know it, for it is written about midnight, kachatzot alayla, right? Yitzhak Mitzrayim, Moshe says kachatzot alayla because he doesn't even, like I said before, if you go out, you don't see anything changing. Okay, so the Gemara is actually saying exactly that. So even Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know exactly when midnight is. So how did David HaMelech know? I'll skip a little bit to where it says six. Okay, David had a sign. For so said Rav Acha bar Bizana in the name of Rabbi Shimon the pious, Rabbi Shimon Chassid, a harp was hanging above David's bed. They translate kinor here as a harp. Today it's a violin, but maybe it's more accurate to translate it as a harp. As soon as midnight arrived, the north wind came and blew upon it, and it played of itself. He arose immediately and studied the Torah until the break of dawn. And after the break of dawn, the wise men of Israel came in to see him, and said to him, our Lord the King, Israel, your people require sustenance. He said to them, let them go out and make a living one from the other. They said to him, a handful cannot satisfy a lion, nor can a pit be filled up with its own clods. So there's not enough. He said to them, then go out in troops and attack the enemy for plunder. They once took counsel, at once took counsel with Ahitophel and consulted the Sanhedrin and questions the Urim Tumim. Okay? And it continues on and on. And the interesting thing is that it doesn't stop here. The Gemara continues telling us more and more about David HaMelech, and this looks like it's getting carried away a little bit, because this was not the topic of the sugya. Right? The sugya was talking originally about the time of Kriyat Shema, which ends at the, according to the first opinion in the Mishnah, at the end of the first watch, at the after a third of the night. Okay, and then it brought the fact that there are two opinions, whether there are three watches or four watches during the night. But what do they have to go into all this story about David HaMelech? Okay, we understood. You bring a source from David HaMelech that there are four watches. Okay, fine. What do you need this whole agadita for? Okay, it looks like it's just someone getting carried away. And again, we ask, what is the role of agada? Okay, in a halachic sugya like this? So I think that if we look and try to understand, again, based on the way Rebbe created the first chapter in Brachot, he focused on the concepts of time and the Jewish time. Jewish time begins at sunrise or begins at sunset and goes to sunrise and then to sunset. Okay, Jewish time relies on sunrise and sunset. There's very clear times during the day in nature. And you see that, and this is very important. There's many, many halachot, okay, that have to do with these times. It's Shabbat, and Chagim, and all of davening, all of tefillah, and Kriyat Shema. So it's very important for Rebbe to instate these times, okay, this dealing with this issue of time in the first chapter. And dealing also with the issue of day and night, and the difference between them, and between what they symbolize. And that's what the Jewish calendar relies upon, and Jewish halacha relies upon, day and night as we know them, as opposed to the English calendar, which changes at midnight or changes in the middle of the winter. Okay, the Jewish calendar changes at the beginning of fall, beginning of the agricultural year, and it changes, what's more important, it changes all the time during sunset and sunrise. Okay, these are the critical times in halacha. And when you keep that in mind, if you really read the sugyot here, the wider context, it really enters your mind those times that are so critical. Those are the Jewish times, sunrise and sunset. Then all of a sudden, you start reading this Agadat HaAvot HaDavid HaMelech. And in this context, what does David HaMelech do? He starts at the wrong time. Or at least, according to the way the sugya, the halacha designs time, David HaMelech ignores this. He starts at a different time, at midnight. That's where he wakes up. Okay, the harp wakes him up, or there are different opinions here. And he's starting his day not in a regular Jewish way. He's actually defying the regular times, or he's actually breaking. Okay, there's a certain contrast, there's a certain tension here. Now you can really understand that only if you read halacha and Agadah together. You read the wider context here. And you read these things together, and you see how much of the tension there is here. We know what David HaMelech is actually doing. And so what is David HaMelech doing? Is he accepting the Goyish concept of time? I don't think so. I think he's, the Gemara brings a story here to say something else. You see, the original occasion when this concept of time was broken was in Yetziat Mitzrayim, right? The Gemara mentioned that. And why does the Yetziat Mitzrayim take place, or Makat Bechorot take place at midnight? Because, at least according to the sugya here, in the eyes of the sugya, because of what this symbolizes. Because night symbolizes evil. And when you, when God starts taking Israel out of Egypt with Makat Bechorot at midnight, he's actually breaking this concept of evil. He's not accepting the fact that there's good and evil. He's actually breaking it. Because in this world, Judaism accepts the fact that there's good and evil. The world can't be perfect. And evil is part of the world. And the Yetzer Hara is part of our life. And that's why there's day and night. That's why the original light that was it the time of the creation, God put it away. It was Nignas, right? The or Agamuz. He put it away and he left us just with the light of the sun and the moon in order for there to be day and night. That is Minagosha Olam. That is the course of the world where there is day and there's also night. There's good and there's evil. It's something that Judaism doesn't try to ignore. It accepts it. It accepts the fact that that's part of this world. And it's an important part of the world because without good and evil in the world, there's actually no free choice. And with no free choice, there's no humanity. Okay, a life of only light. When God, what does it mean? What's the origin? What does it really mean? It means that God's ways are actually, in everything in the world. But if you see God present all the time, then you don't really have a choice. And you're not choosing good because you're really choosing it. It's impossible to make a different choice. So God puts that light away and leaves the world in a situation where there's both light and darkness, and you have to accept that, and you have to try to fight evil inside yourself and in the world as best as you can. But I think as opposed to other pagan cultures and opposed to Christianity, which is the opposite in a certain way. Judaism, on one hand, accepts the fact that this world has good and evil. See, Christianity says that this world is all evil. There's nothing good. Right? They actually, that's what they hold. And the material world, there's nothing good about it, and it's all evil. Pagan cultures, in a certain sense, saw it the other way around and celebrated the material world completely. This pagan holiday, by the way, of Saturnalia, was a totally wild holiday with complete freedom to do anything, and people went wild, and their inclinations went wild, whatever they wanted to do. And so, but I think Fazal is saying, on one hand, we're not ignoring the fact that there's good and bad, and it's part of the world, it's Minago Shalom. But on the other hand, it's our job to fight evil. But we're fighting in a reality where we know that evil will continue to exist, at least in this world. But at the same time, once in a while, they remind us that there's also a different reality. Just like in Yitzhak Mitzrayim, in the world to come, God will banish evil completely. And David HaMelech is actually giving us a small reminder of that. When David HaMelech defies the regular division of time between day and night, he's actually saying night can be broken up, evil can be broken up. Because what is he doing? He's actually learning or davening during night. That's not the natural thing that people do. People sleep during the night. And he's saying, I'm going to get up at midnight and I'm going to completely break the system, not in order to really break it, but in order to show that there's a hope, that it really, in the end, that's what's going to happen. But the Gemara mentions it in Haggadah, okay? Right after it makes sure that we understand that our daily, the way that we live every day is actually determined by halakha. And halakha divides the day differently, with sunset and sunrise. But we remember that there's also a hope of doing it differently in a way that breaks this concept of night, the concept of evil, and banishes it totally. So, to summarize it, just to conclude, I think that the way that we saw Haggadah and Halakha interacting here, in ways that create a tension between them. And these are the most interesting cases. There are other cases of Halakha and Haggadah. Haggadah does many other things in Sugiyot. But I think in these two Sugiyot, the Haggadah looks as if it appears to contradict what the Halakha is actually, the system that the Halakha is creating, but actually is complementing it and showing a different side to it. And I think together they create a full, complete picture.
Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Yashikoach. Okay. Lila Tov. Shavua Tov.